We're Coast to Coast AM, right? This is a show that reaches out to millions of people every week across a network of 525 radio stations in North America, just North America alone, not to mention all of the podcasting and online listening that goes on globally. So this is not just a show about how well things are going here in the United States, despite what you might be thinking, but also on how well things are going worldwide. It's actually hard to find places on the planet that aren't doing incredibly better than they were just 40 years ago. And that the difference, let's even make it 50 years ago. Let's go back into the 1950s. The difference in the last 50 years in where we were to where we are now is coming at such, it came at a rate that was faster than the improvements in the period before it. Does that make any sense? So in the distance it would have taken in the last 50 years, prior to that, perhaps, the greatest advances took about 100 years. Or, you know, and in the future, we might even think that will be cut in half. So the advances we've enjoyed in the last 50 years will enjoy even more advances, say, in the next 25 years. That our future is always on an arc up, or at least if we can trust the past. And there is no time, by the way, when you can look back and say, oh, well, it was just so much better in the 1950s. I'm talking about the book, The Rational Optimist, How Prosperity Evolves. And it tells us a lot about our future, that our future is better than we can imagine, and it's coming faster than we are probably prepared for it. There are a few pockets of where the prosperity hasn't grown at the same rates as others. But just to give you an idea, say, well, let's use a statistic that's pretty easy to track. Let's just take it out of the, you know, out of the money. And let's just think about the difference that having money makes in our lives. Americans were pretty well off in the 1950s. We were 3 inches taller as a society in 1950 than we were at the turn of the century just 50 years before it. So that can, that speaks to medicine, that speaks to, you know, nutrition, that speaks to prosperity, just having enough, you know, protein. But also when you look at this, there were twice, Americans spent twice as much on medicine in the 1950s as we did on funerals. Now, that was a trend that was reversed 50 years prior. In 1900, Americans were spending twice as much on funerals as we were on medicine. And this is just what keeps happening over and over again. With every successive generation, things actually get better, if we could look at it that way. And that's why we have so much to look forward to the future. For example, looking back now, we think about the 1955 America, right? We got the luxuriating and beautiful cars, comforts, gadgets. And yet every one of those people in the 1950s, you ready for this? Would qualify underneath the poverty line for America today. Everyone would be, well, you know, the billionaire exceptions of the 50s. Every one of those people would be below our poverty line today. And so it will be for the future. Just what do the statistics show us about our future? We'll find out coming out next hour. Matt Ridley is the also the best-selling Times author of a book called Genome, which changed the way people thought about genetics. He's going to change the way you think about economics and what you have to look forward to in not just the last 50, you know, out of the next 50 years, but in the next 25, maybe the next 10. And he sees the trends, and he'll tell us where we're going coming up next hour. I'll tell you where we are right now with a little crypto news and an important update from Peter Lance, investigative reporter, next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett. Well, I want you to be ready to think on your feet here on this news coming up from Peter Lance. We'll get to that coming up in just a moment on Coast to Coast. And then next hour, the Rational Optimist takes a look at the future. You think about gold prices and the future of gold prices? Yeah, gold prices could go up. One of the reasons they'll go up, I think, is after reading this book, or at least a lot of it, is that things are going to get better. There'll be even more uses for gold, by the way, in the future, and we'll talk about that coming up on Coast to Coast. All right, so a little bit on the website tonight. Take a look at it. There's a video of the hail that the hailstorm that hit Oklahoma. It's, you know, these are huge hailstones that are coming down. If you haven't seen it yet, you should go take a look at that at coasttocoastam.com. There's also a story about the man who pulls a plane with his eyelids. I'm not exactly sure what that proves. You know, I mean, you can't exercise your eyelids. You're either born with eyelids that can withstand that, or you're not. Strongest guy in the world with weak breakaway eyelids, and I think you lose your photo op. But anyway, go take it. I don't want to, like, you know, the guy's still cool that he could do it, but take a look online for that. Also, there's the story about the British policeman that wins the UFO award. He beat out an alert Piccadilly Circus T-shirt vendor. And then scientists find in the Timor Sea a meteorite crater that they're just beginning to sort out. When was this crater created, and what were the implications at the time? And statins, the side effects are worse than you feared. You heard that first on this show. We were talking about the problem with statins. Well, statins are still being advertised as, you know, our salvation. We were calling that into question with a great guest a couple of years ago. And I haven't investigated this yet, but I will. The story of Bigfoot alive and living in greater Minnesota. Well, it's sort of what we call outstate Minnesota, up toward the in the northern third of the state, closer to Canada than it is to me. Up around the Chippewa National Forest, there's a small town called Bena, and that's the center of this investigation. If you take a look at the story at coasttocoastam.com, you'll see people there have been having video sightings, collecting physical evidence of a creature that would appear to be living in the National Forest area. Bena's about a town like 100 people or something. It's up in the greater Brainerd metropolitan area. But if you look at it on a map, you see just it's pretty isolated. It would kind of make sense if the people up there have been catching some sightings. I think I'm going to do that. I'll make a day trip out of that coming up, and I'll report back to you. I'll try and hook up with the people that are mentioned in this story from KSAX, which is a TV station in Alexandria, and we'll find out the latest on these Bigfoot sightings. Hunters there, woodsmen, outdoor sports enthusiasts, 75 reports of sightings, captured images, and Bigfoot footprints in just the last 3 years. We'll get on that, you know, because I think it's important to try to figure things out one way or another, to try to get to the bottom of something, much like the work that Peter Lance has been doing for years and doing it live here on Coast to Coast. He joins us with the latest on what he's been working on. And we won't tell you where the piece, but Peter Lance is working on a new investigative piece that picks up on a conversation he had a couple of weeks ago with George Norrie just after the Times Square attempted bombing. Hey, Peter Lance.
Hey, Ian. Great to be with you.
Good. I think you make a good point in your last email to not mention where this piece is that you're thinking about, that you're going to be placing an article on this investigation coming up, because you have reasons to think that the government might try to spike it.
Yeah, I think the feds will, anything that's critical of the FBI, the Justice Department, they have the biggest lobby, not only in Capitol Hill, but in Hollywood, and they routinely go out of their way to discourage the mainstream media from doing pieces critical of the Justice Department and the FBI. So I have every reason to just stay under the radar. But I will say that one of the most gratifying things that's happened to me, you know, I've been doing this investigation on the two bin Laden offices of origin, the New York office of the Bureau and the Southern District Prosecutor's Office, since right after 9/11. And, you know, I always like to refer people to my website, peterlance.com, because in the upper right-hand corner is the timeline for my latest book, Triple Cross, that people can download as a PDF and kind of reference it as we talk about some of these issues. But from my first book, I talked about the story of this incredible guy named Imad Salem, who investigated, who basically was an ex-Egyptian army officer. He was the antithesis to Ali Muhammad, the evil ex-Egyptian army officer who was working for Al-Qaeda. And this guy risked his life, you know, went undercover and infiltrated the cell around the first World Trade Center bombing, was kind of forced out by an inexperienced suit named Carson Dunbar. And when I say forced out, they changed the rules of engagement on him and told him he had to wear a wire, et cetera. And so he withdrew. And then the World Trade Center bombing happened, and they pulled him back within days. And he literally rounded up the blind sheikh and nine others in this plot to blow up the bridges and tunnels into Manhattan, the UN, et cetera. The most important undercover asset in the history of the war on terror, bar none. And he's been in witness protection for many years, and he reached out to me last fall because he said, he contacted me and said I was the only reporter that had really fairly told his story. But even that, in that sense, I had only told a part of it. And he's given his story to me now, and it's going to be in this piece, in the lead piece in the September issue of a magazine that hopefully, you know, when we get closer to it and it's locked, we'll talk about it, you know.
Sure. We'll talk more about that in just a second, too, because I think that's very interesting to get into what even finer details of what he went through as an FBI informant, and both what he knew, what he experienced, and what he has to say now. But let's also talk about then the real quickly about how the FBI is doing these days, because, you know, they've got kind of an impossible job. They have to be perfect. You know, they have to get it exactly right. They have to get everything out there, and they have to. But there's also seemingly you would think for as high of stakes as they often talk about that we're living in, there seems to be a lot of times when they are kind of asleep at the switch at the FBI.
Well, you know, look, the FBI, since the early 80s, under President Reagan, he tasked the FBI to be in charge of protecting the U.S. homeland from terrorism. They are the principal of the big five agencies charged with protecting America, the states, if you will, okay? And so you know, they've had this job. The first Joint Terrorism Task Force was located in New York City. The biggest office of the Bureau outside of Washington is in New York City. All of the 9/11 related, or all of the terrorism cases prior to 9/11, the original Trade Center bombing case in 94, what they called this Day of Terror case in 95, the Bojinka case in 96, the Second World Trade in 97, which convicted Ramzi Youssef and of the bombing, and the famous African Embassy case, all investigated by the New York office of the Bureau, prosecuted by the Southern District. And yet, as I've documented, and as I think no mainstream journalist has, the astonishing number of failures on the road to 9/11. But then you would think, well, look, after 9/11, after a wake-up call like that, the Bureau would have just pulled it together. And in fact, they got a huge infusion of money. Director Mueller dedicated 6,000, half of their 12,000 agents to counterterrorism. And yet, years after, we're coming up on the 10th anniversary, and just some of the benchmarks, there's still less than 100. I think it's closer to 60 Arab-speaking agents out of 6,000. There are hundreds of millions of dollars spent on what was called Trilogy, this virtual case file system that was supposed to take them out of their paper-driven culture so that they could do what you and I could do with a smartphone and punch in an Islamic, you know, suspect's name and connect the dots to the files in D.C.
That
they scrapped that in 05. Then they hired Lockheed Martin to spend another $300 million on a thing called Sentinel. And recently there's a report that still hasn't been fully deployed, and it's $30 million over budget. Can I just say this one other thing?
Yeah.
And I'll, you know, as recently as this week, the New York Times reported that, you know, the Senate Intelligence Committee issued a report on the Christmas bomber, Farouk Umar Abdul Muttalab, and this young kid who tried to, you know, blow up this Northwest flight. And buried at the end of the article by Scott Shane, Here's a paragraph. I'm going to read it. This is at the end of the article. A counterterrorism analyst at the Federal Bureau of Investigation, the report said, never saw relevant information on Mr. Abdul Muttalab because her computer profile was configured incorrectly. The National Security Agency, which intercepts electronic communications, quote, did not pursue potential collection opportunities that could have identified the threat, it said. Now, how are you a presumably a, you know, senior analyst with the FBI, you know, and how do you not have your computer properly configured at this point?
I think that, and that was the piece I was thinking of to this puzzle, that here they, I mean, the stakes are that high, and mistakes that low seem to be what almost puts us behind the eight ball every time. That's a pattern we see over and over again, that were it not for a couple of fluky things, for example, I mean, they lost track of this, they lost track of Shazad on the way to the airport. I mean, then if it hadn't been for somebody else in another city that was looking at the watch list, even he might have just gotten on a plane and been able to get out of Dodge. I mean, it's just, these are close calls that seemingly we should have a much wider margin of error with all of the money we're putting into counterterrorism.
Absolutely, and I'm critical of my brothers and sisters in the media, because, and by the way, my all-time favorite paper is the New York Times. It drops on the door every morning. It's one of the highlights of my day to read the New York Times. So I consider it the greatest paper in America. I think the LA Times and the Wash Post are up there, but the Times should be the best when it comes to this, because it's in New York. It's where the two bin Laden offices of origin are. The Times should be really great at covering this issue of the FBI on the road to 9/11 and beyond, right? And wouldn't you agree?
Yeah, and no, I think so.
Okay, so Scott Shane and other reporters, and I don't mean to single him out tonight, because we don't know what Scott Shane puts in his stories that editors cut out. But one of the astonishing things that happened, a couple of days after the Times Square bombing, there's a piece in the New York Times that basically a profile of Faisal Shazad, right? And you have to jump to the inside jump of the story, and you scroll down a couple of paragraphs, and it says that, quote, George LaMonica, a 35-year-old computer analyst, said he bought his two-bedroom condominium in Norwalk, Connecticut from Mr. Shazad for $261,000 in May of 2004. A few weeks after he moved in, Ms. LaMonica said investigators from the National Joint Terrorism Task Force interviewed him, asking for details of the transaction. It struck LaMonica as unusual that he said detectives told him they were simply checking everything out. Now, first of all, how is it that the New York Times buries, and this was not Scott Shane, this is James Barron and Michael Schmidt, the byline on that piece, quote, from suburban father to terrorism suspect. But how is it that the paper of record, the New York Times, has something like that? And by the way, right after this, there were like 9 blogs that exploded with this revelation.
Right.
Peter Lance was not the only one that went, what? Dropped it by jaw? Okay, and the Times has not followed up on that. Now, if you combine that, the fact that they had this guy in the radar, and then you add the fact that he somehow is able to become a naturalized citizen, travel to Waziristan for 5 months by his own admission, we've been told now since he opened up, and in a hotbed of Taliban activity, comes back to the United States, and by the way, along the way, marries a woman in Colorado who is an American citizen that speeds his naturalization, and is somehow able to construct a would-be weapon of mass destruction 35 miles from New York, and brings it right into the epicenter of one of the most populous cities in the world on a Saturday night. And this guy, the Bureau was on to him in 2004. That is, and then, of course, once they identified him, as you pointed out, they lost him for several hours. How does that happen? See, the problem is people watch 24. It's really funny. Ray Kelly, the commissioner, and the NYPD, by the way, I think did a spectacular job after the fact. But Ray Kelly said, you know, Jack Bauer does it in 24. For us, it took 53 hours. That was the forensic case of grabbing the guy. But that doesn't say anything about how was it the FBI didn't nail this guy long ago.
Right, yeah. And that is... you know, reminiscent of the Fort Hood massacre guy who was putting every effort out there to be caught himself, was on the base working for the government, meeting with the people. They were aware of it. They still didn't think it had risen yet to the level that it eventually, of course, lived out horribly on November 5th of 2009. All right. Well, that's where we'll pick it up with Peter Lance in just a minute, because as we mentioned earlier, he's got a piece focusing on the connection between the Times Square bomb attempt in May of this year, the Christmas Day bombing attempt of last year, and then the Fort Hood massacre. And the person that ties all three of those together is in Peter Lance's crosshairs. And in this new piece coming up, an explosive new piece, he'll tell us the latest about that person and those connections next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett. So coming back with the Peter Lance here in just a second, where he's back on the trail of the man who connects these three most recent attempted and successful terrorist attacks against the United States, or at least that's certainly what it feels like. He's at the center of all three of these things, and he's the man that Peter Lance says may be the first U.S. citizen in history to be marked for assassination with the open approval of the White House. Who is that man? And we'll talk about that approval coming up in just a second with Peter Lance, investigative reporter, working on even details that are developing at this hour in the investigation of the most recent terrorist attack here in the United States, Times Square, beginning of the month. And then coming up next hour, what do we have to be so optimistic about? Why should we look forward to the future? Why should we hope that it gets here faster than we think? The rational optimist explains it all. He'll change everything. Coming up on Coast to Coast, this is Ian Punnett. All right, so Peter Lance is working on his latest piece, which we won't tell you more about, just to say that he's tracking this story. And when he gets closer to publication date, we'll find out where it's going to be. But it's sensitive material because it, too, will be critical of the FBI's handling of this, of the nexus of these investigations between the Times Square bomb attempt made on May 1st, the Christmas Day bomb attempt on the 25th of December, and the Fort Hood massacre on November 5th of last year. So, Peter, what ties all these together, and who is the U.S. citizen that is the first ever in history to have an assassination approved by the White House? What do you mean by that?
You know, first of all, it sounds like a classic Coast to Coast AM conspiracy, doesn't it?
Well, they exist.
I know. Listen, brother. You guys often have it before the mainstream media, but I'm saying when I heard it in your words put forth, it's true. It sounds like some guy's making something up. But let me ask your listeners to just follow along and have a yellow legal pad in front of you, a shirt, cardboard, whatever you want to write on, and connect. I'm going to give you the dots on this guy. His name is Anwar al-Awlaki, and the name is spelled two different ways, typically A-L-A-W-L-A-K-I. He's born in New Mexico. He is a Yemeni cleric. He's 39 years old, born in 1971 in the United States.
Let me jump in real quick. What was he born with that name, or did he change that name when he became Muslim?
No,
was he born
Muslim? He's an ethnic Yemeni with that name. And, anyway, the New York Times reported, just to give you the kind of the latest little thing again, as they say in Dr. Strangelove, my source is the New York Times. Right. April 6, 2010, headline, U.S. approves targeted killing of American cleric. My brother Scott Shane, headline again, Obama administration is taking the extraordinary step of authorizing the targeted killing of an American citizen, radical Muslim cleric Anwar al-Awlaki, believed to have shifted from encouraging attacks in the United States to directly participating in them. And he is believed to be the first person, at least anyone's admitted to have this kind of double O treatment,
right?
You know, shoot to kill. Now, let me just give you some of the background before we get to the three the most recent incidents of terrorism or attempted on the U.S. homeland. And by the way, some of the best reporting on this was from Paul Thompson, who has this great website, historycommons.org. If you go to peterlance.com, if you go to my website, you'll see a lot of this reporting on al-Awlaki on the homepage and links to Paul. Paul did a book called The Terror Timeline that I wrote the preface to. So Paul Thompson deserves a lot of the credit. And also another Paul named Paul Sperry. When I get to one of the most astonishing incidents that happened in 02, Paul Sperry is the guy. So I want to, those men need to be credited because we stand on the shoulders of these guys. 1999, the FBI begins investigating the Charitable Society for Social Welfare, a U.S. branch of a Yemeni charity founded by Sheikh Abdul Majid al-Zindani, a Yemeni imam who the U.S. will officially designate a terrorist in 2004. Who's the vice president? Anwar al-Awlaki. So this is 1999. This is long before the 9/11 attacks, okay?
Right, right.
Cut to January of 2001. When al-Madar and al-Hazmi, these two incredibly visible guys who became the muscle among the muscle hijackers on American 77 that flew into the Pentagon, they got into the U.S. and they were in Los Angeles. They were reportedly met by a guy named Bayoumi, who was reportedly linked to Saudi intelligence, but the Saudis tried to deny the, you know, obviously, you know, distance themselves from that. But this guy Bayoumi helps them in Los Angeles, and they go to San Diego, and they're directly helped by Anwar al-Awlaki. He aids and abets them. He helps them get housing. And here's the first hint of why the FBI really doesn't want this, the full story to come out on this guy. They end up living in the home of a guy named Abdusadr Sheikh, who was an FBI informant, okay? This is in 2001. They're highly visible. They go to the mosque. They register a car. They get tickets to SeaWorld. They put one of them has his name in the phone directory. Highly visible. Now they move, as the 9/11 plot begins to move forward towards the day of reckoning, they move to Virginia. And Anwar al-Awlaki then moves to this mosque called the Dar al-Hijra Islamic Center in Falls Church, Virginia. There, he helps both al-Madar and al-Hazmi and Hani Hanjour, the senior muscle hijacker on AA-77. He's openly helping these guys. And
Peter, I want to jump in. But isn't this, did he not move? You said all three of these guys, so did he not move with the FBI informant that they were living with in L.A.?
No. Anwar al-Awlaki, al-Madar and al-Hazmi were living in a home or connected
right.
to or rented to them by this guy, Abdusadr Sheikh.
Isn't it good news that when they're in L.A., I'm just saying, trying to look for a little good news for the
sure.
FBI, that at least they had an informant there on the ground, an Arab-speaking informant, and the very same people that are threatening to do bad to the United States are being watched by them there. I mean, that's a good thing.
In San Diego, it is a good thing. And there are many instances. If you go to peterlance.com and you get this timeline up, you'll see many instances where courageous, dedicated FBI agents. I'm not an anti-FBI person.
Right.
I'm a pro-FBI doing the job well person. But typically, routinely, time and time again, while the street or brick agents do the job, the senior management screws it up. So let's
right.
just move
right.
forward.
Okay.
From San Diego.
That guy didn't move. The FBI informant did not move with them from San Diego.
No. And in fact,
okay.
that FBI informant, when the joint committee from the congressional committee that first investigated 9/11 prior to the 9/11 commission, they actually heavily redacted. The Justice Department asked for the report on this guy Sheikh to be heavily redacted. They didn't really, and no one's really, Senator Bob Graham really pushed to get to the truth on this guy, and no one to this day has ever really told the full story on Abdusadr Sheikh. But now let's move to Virginia.
Okay. Move to Virginia.
Anwar al-Awlaki moves to this mosque, which, by the way, later on, I'm getting ahead of myself, but when Major Hassan, an accused shooter in the Fort Hood Mosque, when his mother died, they had her funeral at this Dar al-Hijra Mosque, which is his first contact early on with Anwar al-Awlaki. But let's get back to the year 2001.
Okay.
She's connected to three of the hijackers there. 9/11 happens. Now the FBI begins, finally gets around to interviewing him fairly heavily. Now, while he was in San Diego and later in Virginia, he was busted on several occasions for, you know, soliciting prostitutes. He actually got busted twice in San Diego and was put on probation, you know, the ultimate hypocrite. Here's this imam preaching Islamic purity, and he's a, you know, he's chasing hookers, you know.
Right.
And so while he's in Virginia, a clever, again, another conscientious investigator, and it's unclear as to whether it was from the Bureau, says, you know, we can get this guy for crossing state lines because he's going from Virginia and elsewhere with these hookers. And was working up an investigation just to hold him, just to be able to grab him long enough, legitimately, so they could question him. And he splits the country. He goes to Yemen, okay? Now, oh, by the way, a couple of interesting things that would have, you know, really should have rung the cherries at the Hoover building. When they searched the apartment of Ramzi bin el-Shib in Germany, and he was the gopher for Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. He was the number two kind of guy in the 9/11 plot, that helped to execute it. They found al-Awlaki's number in Ramzi bin el-Shib's apartment. That's not exactly coincidental, considering that he was with these other hijackers.
Right.
Two agents. So now in 2002, in March of 2002, al-Awlaki, they're starting to kind of move in on him, the FBI, with this hope of trying to, you know, detain him for the hooker issue in Virginia, when in fact in March he splits in 2002. Now here's one of the most outrageous things that Paul Sperry has documented. October 10th of 2002, the system works again, Al-Awlaki comes back to JFK. Now there's a customs, a State Department, a diplomatic security agent, a DSS agent, and they're the agents on the level of FBI agents in the State Department that protect the embassies, and they do brilliant work. And a guy named Ray Fournier, a federal agent, had been tracking al-Awlaki as part of a joint terrorism task force in Colorado. And he actually had worked up a warrant on him because al-Awlaki had lied and committed a passport violation. He actually got a $20,000 grant from the U.S. Agency for International Development to attend college in Colorado State University in the 90s by saying he was born in Yemen. That's a lie. He's born in the United States. So now this Ray Fournier says, we got something to hold this guy on, guys, okay?
Right. Yeah, let's get him.
Right. So al-Awlaki comes back into the flies into JFK with his family, and on the 10th of October, and the system works. He seemed to have been on the watch list. They find out about the warrant. They detain him for 3 hours. They call the FBI. And if you go to sperryfiles.com, SPERRY files.com, Paul actually has the incident report, the TEC-2 report, which stands for Treasury Enforcement Communication System report. And it basically says that they get a call from a special agent named Kane notifying them that the warrant issued by the State Department has been pulled back the day before, and they let him go again. Okay.
Yeah. And the reason they let him go was because...
It's unclear why the Bureau understands this is Customs doing its job, grabbing this guy, and the Bureau, some agent Kane from the Bureau, I'm looking at the hard copy of the report in my hand that this Paul Sperry has on Sperry Files, and this agent Kane notifies them that the warrant's been pulled back. So he's basically let go. And Ray Fournier, Paul Sperry did a piece for the New York Post on January 13th, and he basically said, quoting Fournier, we were stunned. He was a high-value target. Everybody was excited about the prospect of hooking this guy up under a criminal charge to motivate a conversation with him regarding his relationship with the 9/11 hijackers, and now he's gone. And later, Sperry reports, he's spirited out of the country on a private Saudi jet, okay? And he ends up in Yemen, where in 2006, he is arrested at the urging of the U.S. government. Now, this is during George Bush's administration, George W.,
right.
Okay? And he's in a Yemeni prison, and we can only imagine the kind of, you know, interrogation he experienced there. But in any case, later in 2000, it's reported that somebody in the U.S. government, it's unclear exactly who made the call, urged the Yemenis to release him because he was a U.S. citizen and they were concerned about his rights and the fact that he's being held in a Yemeni facility, a criminal facility. Okay.
But there's got to be somebody there somewhere who we can track down. Who's the person who called to say let him out? I mean, there's got to be a record for that. Okay.
Well, that's I'm giving you the headlines. I'm just trying to tease you on what I'm coming up with.
Okay.
That's part of what I'm working on. But
good.
But look, there's some evidence here that the Saudis have been intervening on this guy's behalf on a regular basis, and you know the kind of lobby they have in Washington. And one of the things that I report on in Triple Cross, and again, peterlance.com, get the timeline. If you go to You see another tragic event that I've discussed in the past, but I'll say it briefly. In 2004, December, brother-in-law of bin Laden, his brother-in-law, is arrested in Morgan Hill, California. The system works, and he's captured with a PDA, which basically has links to the – he's the bag man for the Manila cell of Ramzi Youssef and KSM. That's really the genesis cell for the 9/11 plot. Muhammad Jamal Khalifa is his name, and he is arrested, and they find links back to the New York cell. I mean, this guy is a living connective tissue of what's been going on between al-Qaeda, the New York, and the Manila cell. And Jamie Gorelick, at the behest of Warren Christopher, under pressure from the Jordanian government, pushes for this guy to be released to Jordan. He's got a death sentence hanging over his head, Khalifa, in Jordan, for being involved in some al-Qaeda theater bombings. He's motivated to talk. They find this treasure trove of evidence on him, and yet he is pushed, literally leaves the country. And I was told by Mike, I'm blanking out his name, the brilliant guy, the former head of Alex Station at the CIA, who wrote these books under the name Anon, Mike Schur. Mike Schur told me that when he was finally landed in Saudi Arabia, he was picked up by a limo and embraced by a senior Saudi diplomat, only to end up, you know, going into the wind eventually. And he was murdered, like, within the last 2 years. But the point I'm trying to make is the U.S. has the guy, a similar fact pattern to al-Awlaki, and people in the government, in this case, a woman who goes on to become one of the 9/11 commissioners, Jamie Gorelick, pushes for this guy under pressure from a foreign government.
Okay, so I mean, and again, it comes back to, you're still learning the names to be named in an upcoming piece. We're right. Still learning about this. And yet, in the end, is it just as you have been analyzing all of these and the U.S. called to ask for his release, or he slipped through our fingers one more time? Is it just incompetence, or could there be, at the risk of sounding too conspiratorial, you know, forces within the government, but could there be some sort of concerted effort to keep a percentage of bad guys out there in order to keep justifying these huge expenditures on these software systems and these other efforts to try to round them up?
First of all, you know, I have a certain percentage of your audience that hates me because I don't subscribe to the inside job theory. However, no doubt in my mind, Ian, there's no doubt in my mind that there are certain elements in the, quote, military-industrial complex, the people that profit from war and turmoil, that love the fact that al-Qaeda continues to operate and pose a threat to America. That's a given, number one. Number two, I think the reason for the FBI issue of incompetence, which people don't believe, they believe that the 24 version of the CIA and the FBI, that they can read, you know, they can not just read license plates, but licenses, driver's licenses from outer space. And I just want to say this about the FBI. There's a piece recently that was in Maine Justice, which is one of the top, you know, the websites that covers the Justice Department in a nutshell. The FBI basically still to this day has a practice where they will not allow an agent to record an interview with a suspect. They have to write it down. It's this insane holdover from the Hoover.
Do they really?
I'm serious. Here's the article.
You can't record what?
Listen to this. In a practice that has long been a contentious issue, a Justice Department advisory committee is revealing the FBI practice of memorializing interviews with suspects in handwritten notes rather than recordings. The website reported the issue has become pronounced since an increasing number of local and state law enforcement agencies, like all of them, use video and audio recording devices.
Right.
The website reported the FBI police forbid agents from recording interviews without okay of a special agent in charge. Now, that... You take that kind of archaic thinking, the failure of the virtual case file system, the analyst who didn't have her profile corrected, you know, set on her computer, and then add a big measure of this. The FBI does not want to connect the dots on a guy like al-Awlaki. That's the most dangerous thing about this hit on him. I wouldn't lose any sleep if this man disappeared from the face of the earth. I'm not objecting on moral grounds to somebody whacking this guy because of the what he's done to our country and the threat he poses. But he's much more valuable as a if you grab him and interrogate him and to learn about the failures of the FBI. He's much more valuable. But they don't want it. They want this guy killed.
Or, yeah, either they want him killed or they want him to get away, it would seem. Not the one thing they don't want is they don't want him talking about how incompetent they've been because they don't want to know.
Okay. Exactly.
Well, that's where it'll have to end. But we'll look forward to this. You go finish that piece and get to the bottom of it. Name names, blow the lid off this story, and you know where to turn to us first, okay?
Right. It's all on peterlance.com. Thanks, Ian.
Thank you, Peter. Always interesting. And I thought I was the only one who took notes on shirt cardboard. I do that all the time. I love doing that. Did it all the way through seminary. Coming up on at the top of the hour, Rational Optimist says you have to look forward to the future and you want it to come faster than you believe next on Coast to Coast.